This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss the Colorado Supreme Court's decision finding Donald Trump ineligible for the state ballot. Praveen Gonzalez from the Constitutional Accountability Center explains the 14th Amendment's disqualification clause. It bars insurrectionists from holding public office. Historian and peace activist Matt Meyer joins us to discuss nonviolent direct action. We'll look at the role that nonviolent strategies play as relentless war annihilates entire populations in Gaza and Ukraine. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist. On December 19th, Colorado's top court became the first in the nation to rule that Donald Trump is disqualified from holding office because he engaged in insurrection against the Constitution on January 6, 2021. With this ruling, the Colorado Secretary of State will exclude Trump's name from the state's Republican primary ballot. Voters in three other states are also challenging Trump's eligibility to appear on primary ballots based on the 14th Amendment's disqualification clause. That clause disqualifies from office any individual who has taken an oath to support the Constitution and then, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same. In last week's Colorado decision, a four-justice majority wrote that they were, quote, mindful of our solemn duty to apply the law, without fear or favor, and without being swayed by public reaction to the decisions that the law mandates we reach. As the other three cases are being decided, some people are concerned that enforcing the Constitutional Accountability Clause could escalate political violence. In a recent Newsweek editorial, Praveen Fernandez emphasized the importance of judges heeding the warning of legal scholar Sherilyn Ifill. Ifill notes that when judges have hesitated in the past to apply the provisions of the 14th Amendment, it's had the effect of undermining our democracy's promise. Today, we're pleased to welcome Praveen Fernandez to Law and Disorder. He serves as vice president at the Constitutional Accountability Center in Washington, D.C. The center is a public interest law firm and think tank committed to realizing the progressive ideals embedded in the Constitution's text and history. Praveen brings to the table nearly two decades of experience working on issues related to law, democracy, and civil rights, both within and outside the government. Praveen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's so great to be with you.
Praveen, what was your reaction to last week's news that the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that Donald Trump is disqualified from holding office?
You know, I think the decision was so meticulous. It was driven by facts and the law. And I think it represents a huge win for Colorado voters, for democracy, and constitutional accountability in general. It affirmed the district court's carefully drawn factual findings that January 6th was an insurrection and that Donald Trump engaged in it. And it reversed the district court in some other ways by finding that the disqualification clause applies to presidents and to the presidency, as we had urged the court to do in the Constitutional Accountability Center's amicus brief. So I think what I think was powerful was the Colorado Supreme Court held, because Donald Trump engaged in insurrection, he's constitutionally disqualified from serving as president and therefore should not be listed on the presidential primary ballot in Colorado.
Now, before we dig in a bit to the decision and the repercussions, you're vice president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, so obviously this case really goes to the heart of your mission. Can you briefly tell us what other issues your work involves at the center?
Sure, Heidi. We're a progressive public interest law firm and think tank, and we don't have a specific issue area focus, which has allowed us to be involved in almost every issue that progressives care about. Think about reproductive rights, LGBTQ plus equality, immigrant rights, protecting the environment, et cetera. We don't have an issue focus, but we do have a methodology. And I guess for lack of a better description, some have described it as progressive originalism. And what we believe is that we think that conservatives have told, you know, a false account of what the text and history of the Constitution actually dictates. And what the text and history of the Constitution actually supports, we believe, is progressive outcomes, outcomes that make our nation freer and fairer and more inclusive. And so we are dedicated to ensuring that text and history arguments are presented before the court.
Yes, I've got to say that when I was reading about the organization online, I was really interested to see the reference to the Constitution's text, because for so many of us, when we hear textualism or originalism, we think of Scalia and more conservative analyses. I have to ask, is your organization at all related to the Constitution Center?
That's another great group, but no, we have no formal arrangement with the Constitution Center. The Constitutional Accountability Center is just a standalone organization. But I thought your comment was so good. I would say that, you know, years ago I probably would have had the same visceral reaction, and I think that's partially just because conservatives have told a distorted story about the Constitution, and I think that's either because they fetishized the base document from the 1700s and paid short shrift to the amendments, which, of course, in stepwise fashion made our nation, you know, incrementally freer and fairer and more inclusive. But sometimes also, you know, the progressive history has been discarded when it didn't suit conservative either jurists or litigants. And so, for instance, let me just give one example, which might make it seem a little bit less abstract, because if I'm saying it, it might not make sense. You know, we're the sort of group that likes to present these text and history arguments. So if you think about, like, this last term at the Supreme Court, as the justices were considering affirmative action and were faced with arguments by conservatives that, you know, the equal protection language in the 14th Amendment somehow mandated race blindness and would render affirmative action unconstitutional. So we were a group that dove into the historical record, the enactment history around the 14th Amendment. And what we found, which will, of course, be of no surprise to Reconstruction-era scholars, is that we found that the same Congress, the 39th Congress, that shaped and proposed the 14th Amendment, also passed landmark pieces of legislation, such as the Freedmen's Bureau Act, which was explicitly race-conscious and which provided race-conscious remedies to address the undeniable history of discrimination against Black Americans. So, in other words, we don't think that the historical record in any way makes problematic affirmative action. In fact, we think that the historical record made it clear that the framers of the 14th Amendment didn't find that the 14th Amendment's provisions were incompatible with race-conscious remedies. And arguably, as one of my colleagues, David Gams, often says, the framers of the 14th Amendment could be considered the originators of affirmative action. And so that's the sort of historical record that we try to bring in our amicus briefs. And it tries to combat, I think, a story that conservatives often tell that distorts the enactment history of constitutional provisions.
Oh, thank you. And yes, I noticed that your organization has filed a few hundred amicus briefs, something that I think is really important to sort of help the public understand issues that are being litigated in these so-called friend of the court briefs. Speaking of the 14th Amendment, Praveen, can you describe briefly when was Section 3, the Disqualification Clause, written, and why was it written?
Oh, it's a great question. So I've already referenced the Reconstruction Amendments a little bit. So Section 3 is part of the 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868. And the 14th Amendment, along with the 13th and 15th Amendments, is considered a Reconstruction Amendment. That means an amendment that was added in the period of our history after the Civil War, a period so significant that some historians refer to it as the second founding of our nation, and that the historical backdrop is important here. These amendments were added as our nation was coming out of this violent war that nearly tore our union apart. And we were grappling, of course, with the fact that some of the promises in the Declaration of Independence were not only not fully meaningful, but were purely illusory to a large chunk of our nation. And, you know, when you think about the brutal institution of slavery and its subjugation, it proves that a lot of the soaring language of the Declaration of Independence, you know, was illusory for our nation, and sort of it the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were trying to address that, trying to bring our nation out of the war, trying to do things that stabilized our democracy, made it more fair, more equal, and more inclusive. So, you know, you're thinking of the abolition of chattel slavery, the Equal Protection Amendment, birthright citizenship, you know, expanding the voting rights of individuals. And so the historical backdrop is important for this particular provision, Section 3, because, you know, what we faced in this fragile nation coming out of the Civil War is the fact that there were a lot of people who had taken oaths to support the Constitution. So think of Confederate generals, Confederates, et cetera, who had taken up arms against our nation. And there was a fear that was reflected by the framers of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment that if Section 3 was not drafted, you would have individuals who had taken an oath to support the Constitution, who had then violated that oath by taking up arms against our nation, then vying to serve in office again. And they were profoundly worried about the destabilizing effect that would have on the nation that was trying to come out of this conflict. And they considered lots of different versions, some that were specific to Confederate officers, and they decided instead to have this more open-ended language about officers and insurrection, not Confederate officers, but officers. And so that's the backdrop of when this amendment was considered and ratified in the late 1800s.
Oh, thank you for that. Let's bring it back to current day for a moment. What are the other three states where lawsuits have been brought to disqualify Trump from the ballots? And are they all similar, basically, in their demands to the Colorado case?
Right. Minnesota, Michigan, and Oregon are the other three states, you know, where these lawsuits have been brought. And, you know, there are some differences because the primary systems are different in each state. And obviously, there are different groups that are involved with that. The one in Colorado, the lawyers were the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington and local council. But yes, you know, the essence of all the lawsuits are the same. It's challenges by voters who are asking that someone who's constitutionally ineligible to hold office not be on their primary ballot.
Praveen, going back to what you mentioned about the addition of this clause, some fear that violence from Trump supporters will result around the country if Trump is disqualified. And that fear seems to defeat the framers' very reason for crafting this clause. There's a certain irony there. How heavily do you think that may weigh on jurists deciding these cases?
You know, I think the fear and threat of violence, it, you know, is a real one. Obviously, we saw what happened on January 6th, and so you know, it's a very real and sobering possibility. But I think for individuals who care about the possibility of violence, they should care even more deeply about enforcing this clause, which of course was about anti-democratic behavior. It was about insurrection. It was about using force to tamper with the democratic process. It is reflecting a concern about force and violence. And so we should want to enforce that. And so to the extent we're concerned about it, we should want more, not less, enforcement of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. I'm heartened by the decision from the Colorado Supreme Court that had lots of language in the opinion about taking their responsibility seriously, you know, casting aside how, you know, the opinion would be received by the body politic, you know, which I think you're asking with your very sensitive question. And, you know, just being driven by the facts and the law and, you know, honoring the oaths they took as justices to be supporting the Constitution and driven by the facts and the law. But, you know, honestly, I don't think anybody can say, you know, how this will play out in terms of the reaction from Trump supporters. And I think you're right to be concerned. And I think it's because those concerns are real that we should want to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Praveen, I read with interest your recent Newsweek piece on this topic. One thing that I had a question about is your reference to the fact that some people feel enforcing the disqualification clause of the 14th Amendment is anti-democratic. And I don't really understand that logic. Could you elaborate a bit?
You and me both, Heidi. I don't understand the logic either. I mean, you know, to the best of my ability, I think to summarize the concerns, I think there's some who feel like the voters should be able to vote on any candidate they want. But it ignores the fact that that's not how we have treated presidential qualifications. So if there were somebody who was not yet 35 or who wasn't a natural born citizen, we don't simply say, well, this is a popular candidate, we should let the voters decide. You know, we obey the plain text of the Constitution, which, of course, is itself a democratically enacted document, not only democratically enacted, but by the stringent supermajorities that have to happen for constitutional text to, you know, to be part of our Constitution, right? Like, it has to go through supermajorities, it has to go to the states to be ratified. So this has already gone through the political process and been adopted by the democratic process. And so, you know, it cannot be that obeying the plain text of the constitutional provision here, which is democratically enacted, is somehow anti-democratic. But that was my ability to try to summarize the concerns and say why I don't think people should be, you know, pay those too much heed.
Exactly. I agree. I found it interesting. You also mentioned that the framers of the clause did create a way to remove a disqualification through the political process. So if someone is disqualified from serving in public office, Congress may, by a two-thirds margin in each chamber, reverse that decision. And I believe that happened in the late 1800s, correct? There was an incident where it was reversed?
You're exactly right. There's a very clear provision that allows Congress to remove the disqualification, and that actually happened twice in the late 1800s. There were two Confederate amnesty acts that were considered and then passed by Congress by that supermajority, which shamefully, in my opinion, removed the disqualification. But, you know, regardless of your feelings about that, it just shows that there is a clear congressional path if Congress wants to remove this disqualification. So I think that the framers of this amendment were very careful to allow a variety of different actors, including Congress, to be part of a conversation about constitutional accountability to this provision.
Now, the group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics, also based in Washington, D.C., was successful last year in using Section 3 to successfully block a New Mexico county commissioner who also participated in the January 6th insurrection from holding public office. I find that hopeful. Does it give you hope that more states may bring disqualification suits, especially now in light of Colorado's ruling?
I mean, I think that's right. And I should say that Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington also, you know, were the lawyers who are representing the voters in Colorado, along with local counsel. And so the New Mexico County Commissioner Coy Griffin, who you know, who was removed through 14.3 action that you're referencing, you know, that was groundbreaking when it happened because it had been one of the first adjudications in, you know, over 100 years, and I think it's hopeful to me that not only would more suits be brought for officers who violated their oaths and engaged in insurrection, but I also hope it will be a warning shot for future potential insurrectionists saying, okay, I've got to take this oath seriously, because if I plan to hold office again in the future, or even if I plan to hold office right now, you know, this oath I took has to be one that I take seriously. So I think it's hopeful not only for other disqualification suits, but it's also hopeful as a constitutional signal that this provision in the Constitution is not a mere ornament, it's not a dead letter, it's a real constitutional provision, and it has force of law.
Praveen, we now come to the million-dollar question. With the Colorado ruling, this case is likely going to end up before the Supreme Court. And I wanted to note that in a 2012 decision in a Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals case, then-Judge Neil Gorsuch ruled that a state's legitimate interest in protecting the integrity and practical functioning of the political process precludes it, and I'm quoting here from the now justice, to exclude from the ballot candidates who are constitutionally prohibited from assuming office. Does that give you any hope that the Supreme Court might do the right thing if this case reaches them? And we should note that by the time this show airs, there's a possibility it might go before the high court.
It does give me hope that the Supreme Court will do the right thing. You're citing this Hassan decision from the Tenth Circuit of Court of Appeals that then Judge Gorsuch wrote, who's now Justice Gorsuch, and so we know there's at least one person who has a record of saying that, you know, yes, states have this interest in protecting the integrity of their political process, and of course they're allowed to exclude from the ballot candidates who are constitutionally ineligible from assuming office. And of course that one was about someone who wanted to run for presidential office who was not born in the United States, and so, you know, it's another presidential constitutional requirement that's in the plain text. I think the other thing that gives me hope is that the text and history of this constitutional provision is so clear, and there have been a number of justices who at least have professed to be governed by text and history. There are a number of individuals who said that they're originalists and said they care about the enactment history of a provision as they are trying to figure out what a provision means. And, you know, if you're faithful to that methodology, the results here should be clear. And, you know, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful about that.
We just have a few minutes remaining, Praveen, and I know this is an extremely busy few days for you in light of the Colorado decision, so I'd like to thank you for joining us. As we mentioned earlier, the Constitutional Accountability Center has filed, what I see, more than 300 amicus briefs, and 100 of those have been before the Supreme Court. If there's time, do you anticipate filing one in this case?
You know, actually, I just checked with, because I was just thinking about the numbers, I just checked with CAC's chief counsel, Brianne Gorod, who heads up our litigation shop, and I actually think we're now a little north of 400 amicus briefs and 200 at the Supreme Court. So those numbers are outdated. Yes, I do anticipate, you know, obviously we're watching things, and things are moving very quickly at the Supreme Court. It might be by the time your listeners hear this that the Supreme Court has granted cert. Who knows? But we're watching it, and we certainly anticipate. We've been involved at the lower levels with amicus briefs, and we certainly anticipate the potential of being involved if the Supreme Court takes this up.
And Praveen, how can our listeners follow your work and that of the Constitutional Accountability Center?
Oh, you're kind to ask. Well, our website would be the place to start. Our website is theusconstitution.org. We have litigation tabs about all of our cases that describes our cases and links you to the documents, our briefs, et cetera, as well as descriptions of the cases that hopefully will be digestible to a large chunk of your audience. So I would welcome anyone checking out the website.
Well, you've got a great domain name there, I must say.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. It's great to be part of, you know, the mantle of the Constitution, which of course belongs to all of us in this nation.
Yes, well said. Praveen, again, it's been a really busy and eventful week. Thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder, and thank you for your work.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Heidi, and thanks for your interest in this case and our work.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
On February 17, 1815, the United States and Great Britain both ratified the Treaty of Ghent, officially ending the War of 1812. That year, David Low Dodge founded the New York Peace Society, the nation's first formal peace movement. It was followed by the Massachusetts Peace Society. England founded a peace movement around the same time, with Switzerland and France following suit in 1821 and 1830, respectively. Most other European countries created peace movements after 1850. Successful nonviolent protest strategies in the United States are most often associated with the civil rights movement in the South during the 1950s and 60s. Leaders such as Ella Baker, Martin Luther King Jr., A.J. Mustie, Bayard Rustin, and John Lewis dedicated their lives to the philosophy of nonviolence and studied its successful use by Mahatma Gandhi to free India from Britain's colonial grip. But as war and carnage wage in the Middle East and in Ukraine, and as political violence is on the uptick in the United States, peaceful protests do not seem to be as impactful as in earlier decades. Law and Disorder takes a look at the state of peace studies and peace actions in the U.S. and abroad. We're joined by internationally noted historian and organizer Matt Meyer. Matt serves as Secretary General of the International Peace Research Association. It's the world's leading consortium of university-based professors, scholars, students, and community leaders. Matt is also the senior research scholar at the University of Massachusetts Amherst's Resistance Studies Initiative and has been active with the War Resisters International and the International Fellowship of Reconciliation. He also serves on the A.J. Mustie Institute's board of directors. The author and editor of more than a dozen books, Matt's work focuses on 21st century decolonization, African peace studies, the studies and tactics of movement building, the significance of support for political prisoners, and the abolition of white supremacy. Matt Meyer, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Heidi, it's so great to be here. Thanks for having me again.
Before we start, I want to let listeners know that Matt and I actually work together not in the radio studio, but at the A.J. Mustie Memorial Institute. So Matt is one of my bosses in the rest of the world.
Well, okay. I mean, actually, even before you were hired as executive director of the Mustie Institute, you know, all your years of work at the National Lawyers Guild, my work for the freedom of political prisoners, our work together against movement repression, you know, many, many years of great work together. Let's just say this for the next half hour. I'm not your boss. We're just old friends and comrades.
Excellent. Matt, the United States sends tens of billions of dollars to fund the military in Ukraine with little objection from many in Congress or the media. President Biden is asking Congress for billions of additional dollars for Israel's war effort. With all this going on, where is the peace movement in this country?
Well, I think that's in some ways a very central question that people have been asking for years and years now. Part of the answer is quite depressing and negative. In all my years, my decades in the leadership of different peace and nonviolence organizations and in coalition work, in some ways, the peace movement in the U.S., I think, is at an all-time low ebb. some of the coalitions that were built by organizations just naturally meeting with one another, having staffs and leadership in conversation with one another, the kinds of things that Reverend A.J. Musty, the man, did, and that happened during the Vietnam War and immediately after that, haven't happened in some ways since the 1980s. It's not that it never happens or it happens nowhere, but those coalitions and that kind of movement is not as vibrant. On the other hand, I want to actually point to two recent books. You noted, in addition to my organizing and activist parts, I'm an academic in some ways, and two colleagues in the Peace History Society just put out two books that I think are noteworthy. David Courtwright, who was the former director of the Kroc Institute at University of Notre Dame, put out a book called A Peaceful Superpower: Lessons from the World's Largest Peace Movement. And that is about what many would not think of as a powerful force, but the movement to end the war in Iraq. February of 2003, the largest global and many, many huge demonstrations here in the U.S. against that war. Did it stop the war, full stop? No. But the lesson, and part of the lesson, is that even when we don't see an apparent victory, there are still many policy shifts, changes, and invisibilized victories that do exist. And then another friend, Carolyn Eisenberg, also has a new book out called Fire and Rain, which speaks about the movement against the war in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. That, on the other hand, is more well-known, more documented. But after pouring through decades of now declassified files and going to Vietnam and getting some of their files, Dr. Eisenberg, Rusty Eisenberg, uncovered some of the many hidden changes in Nixon, Kissinger, and other policies that that movement made. So Dave Dellinger used to say, we have more power than we know. And I think that's still true. The peace movement in the U.S. is not in a great shape, but there's still a lot of work that's being done that does have an effect, and that even though we may not see an end to war or an end to U.S. Imperialist aggression, there are changes and shifts that do save lives on a day-to-day basis.
Now, Matt, you're involved in many international peace-related efforts and institutions. How does the U.S. peace movement compare with international ones?
Good question, Heidi. I think the key is that often even internationalists in the U.S. don't look at international movements, but think, oh, since the U.S. is the center of militarism and policing and aggression, our peace movement must be the center of things as well. And I think the U.S. peace movement does not compare too favorably, but it's also true there are low tides of peace coalition and mobilization work all over the world. I think what we've seen are burgeoning movements from the global south, in particular from Africa, Latin America, throughout Asia and the Pacific, that in fact are using a greater diversity of tactics, often with greater levels of mobilization than we see here in the U.S. However, there's an opportunity now for a partnership between peace movements globally. If we can somehow get out of a U.S.-centric or Eurocentric model, I think we can build global peace movements on a deeper level than we ever have before. So the last few months, you know, ironically, the tragedies in Gaza, the genocidal policies of the Israeli government and military against the people of Palestine have sparked the beginnings of what feels like an actual movement. And I think we have some great possibilities to build upon that in the coming months and in 2024.
And we should add, of course, that as we live in the digital age, a lot of things have changed in how organizing is done. Now electronically connecting different continents through our wonderful internet.
That's exactly right, Heidi. And, you know, even as organizing door-to-door, knocking, you know, on just hello, saying hello to your neighbor, certainly mobilizations in the street and to Washington, D.C., or to capitals when necessary. Those things are still as important, person-to-person meetings, as vibrant as ever. However, our ability to get reliable on-the-ground information from leaders in every corner of the world is different than it was even 10 years ago. You know, even in the middle of Gaza, in Palestine, in the West Bank and other places, even in the midst of Ukraine and Russia, we can have more direct connections with embattled grassroots peace movements there and peace activists there than we ever were able to do because of that digital connection. So that's a great point, Heidi. I strongly agree with that.
Now, believe it or not, Matt, Martin Luther King Day is just around the corner. And as you know, every year at the Musty Institute, because we have a series of educational pamphlets, they're more than pamphlets, they're small booklets, and one of them covers several speeches of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we like to mail those out to schools and other places that can use them. What does peace education look like in our school system?
And Heidi, I can't begin answering that without also saying, you know, you and I did co-edit a fairly recent Musty document on the radical roots and nature of Dr. King, where it talked about his strong anti-imperialist and internationalist perspectives, his discussions about, you know, not only Southeast Asia, but Puerto Rico and other places. So peace education in the U.S. continues to spread out in the face of junior ROTC and continued registration for the draft and other things that are hitting young people very directly. And, of course, the so-called poverty draft, the fact that the economics of the U.S. means that many people in the school systems, many high school students, look to the military as the place of best, so-called best or only employment. But there is a peace education, I would say maybe slight growth, but over the last 10 years, tremendous growth, where we have not so much a movement, but in terms of curriculum development, in terms of teacher training materials, in terms of books, and I think beginning, in terms of youth and student clubs and youth and student activism. So peace education within the U.S. school system, I think, is a little better than the U.S. peace movement, and let's hope that that continues to be the case.
Now, Matt, you have a rather UN type title, Secretary General of the International Peace Research Association. What does that organization do?
Yes, thank you. The International Peace Research Association, IPRA, was founded 60 years ago. Some of our early leaders, Elise Boulding, Johan Galtung, and others, did have a special relationship with UNESCO and with some of the early UN peace entities and human rights entities. And I think they gave the leadership of the organization that title in accordance. But I think it's also important to say that IPRA is, in fact, very proudly so, an extremely grassroots organization. Unlike the UN, we have proudly had a very, very small infrastructure. So I am the Secretary General, very proudly, of a group of academics, activists, community organizers, scholars of the street, students that are in every corner of the planet. But IPRA doesn't have a big office or a major staff anywhere in the world because we try to give all of our funding and all of our support to one of our five regional associations. At the moment, IPRA's major focus in the last year and in the coming years has been on decolonizing the academy and decolonizing the peace studies movements. What that means is, as we do our general peace research work, as we do our collection of data about war and conflict, conflict resolution, mediation, we also are looking at ways in which the narratives, the voices of those who are centered, not just come from the statisticians or the fancy tenured professors of the global north. Not that we have anything against Global North professors. I think my election was a nod to the fact that we still have space for guys like me, apparently white guys from New York City, to be in the mix. But the majority of the voices, and indeed the majority of our council, is from the Global South. We have a strict policy of gender parity, and we're a democratic organization that has people from Africa, Asia, Latin America, Europe, and the North American continent on all of our councils. So it's not at all a European or North American-dominated council. But this whole idea of decolonization, decolonizing the academy, focusing on white supremacy, has been an orientation for IPRA and is going to continue to be so. I'll say just one more thing about that, which I'm very proud of. It's one of the roles of the Secretary General to host one of our biannual international conferences. And when I was elected about 5 years ago, I said immediately that I really respectfully did not think we'd be able to do a conference in the U.S. Because whoever was elected, whoever was in the White House, sadly, there would just be too many constraints to visa applications and getting people in from various places that wouldn't be allowed into the U.S. otherwise, critical scholars and organizers in their own countries. So we made a decision to hold a conference in a place that was very accessible to the U.S., that was nearby, and that in fact had a leader. He's actually head of peace studies and Africana studies at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. There's a U.S. historic site, Gettysburg. And that professor, Hakeem Williams, is also of Trinidadian descent. We did our major biennial conference in Trinidad as a truly pan-African and pan-American conference with people from all over the Americas, south to north, and from Africa and the rest of the world as well. That same orientation has led us to pick the next conference in 2025, which I'll announce here publicly for the first time. We're going to have IPRA, International Peace Research Association, is going to have for the first time in 2025 the first global peace research conference wholly hosted by and on indigenous lands. And the Maori peoples of Aotearoa, New Zealand, have agreed to host us. There'll be a lot more information about that, but we're very proud to be looking at the indigenous roots of peacemaking globally and in getting knowledge and leadership from indigenous peoples all around the world, including here on Turtle Island, here in North America. We say that and we say here in North America we have to free Leonard Peltier. We have to connect that with the struggles of Native peoples here. But for us in International Peace Research Association, this decolonizing process is part both of the way we look at the world, but also the way we look at our organization.
That sounds fabulous, Matt. I hope that maybe I can attend. Turning to a topic I care deeply about, nonviolent direct action, I'm curious what kind of role that has in social change in the 21st century, especially in the United States, given the crackdown with government laws punishing protest more frequently?
I think that's inevitable, and we have to, and we've seen quite a bit of that. And, you know, I think it's important to connect direct action to overall strategies. I'm not one that believes that any one tactic is going to win any reform, and certainly not going to build a radical movement. Every revolutionary movement in the history of the world has been multiple tactics, including many reforms, and direct action has its role to play. I think we're seeing people be very creative about the fact that boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, direct actions against economies, especially in the Palestine case, is one of the more powerful tools that can be used. I think now very much of what happened in the world in the 1980s, where it looked at the beginning of that decade that there would never be in our lifetime an end to apartheid in South Africa. If and when that ever were to happen long, long into the future, in order for that to happen, there'd be, you know, massive, massive amounts of bloodshed. Now, we see massive amounts of bloodshed in Palestine, as what I think my old friend Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa began to call Israeli apartheid, and now is generally acknowledged. Even Jimmy Carter, President Jimmy Carter, understood it as Israeli apartheid against the Palestinian people. And I think we have an opportunity globally to build a nonviolent direct action movement that looks like the one was built in the 1980s, that through boycott, divestment, and sanctions, through sit-ins in front of, you know, Israeli embassies, through church actions and synagogue actions and witnesses, not just civil disobediences and getting arrested, but yes, that too, we could change policy and maybe see, as we did, not an end to all bad things in South Africa, but an end to political apartheid in a way and on a time frame that we never imagined. And that's one of the best news of the 1980s movements and early 1990s. I think if we build and work hard, we can replicate that in the Middle East. So yes, nonviolent direct action, I think, has a great role to play. And I hope my specific example gives a little insight as to how we might play it.
Yes, it does. And Matt, can you think of an example of a nonviolent strategy currently being used right now by any groups or individuals domestically or internationally to add to that?
Well, you know, since we're talking international, and that is the organization, I'll use an example that's both poignant here at home here in the U.S., but also has international connections. I've been inspired, frankly, by a group I'm not that close to, but I have friends in, called Extinction Rebellion, where climate crisis activists concerned with environmentalism, understanding that when we talk about war and violence, there's also been a war on the earth, that in fact this group of folks, multi-generational but many young activists, have taken nonviolent strategies and direct action techniques and done a lot of creative things to say this is a crisis. We're at a potentially extinction-level moment, and we're going to rebel against the idea of extinction. So Extinction Rebellion is one example that's inspiring me now. Obviously, like any organization, any campaign, any strategic orientation, not doing everything right or everything perfect, but really trying to look at strategy and look at militant, nonviolent tactics to effect real change.
Great example. Matt, what new challenges do peace activists face?
I think the biggest challenge, and maybe now we can come back to the U.S. and come back to this particular movement and moment in history, there is still a sense, there is understandably a sense of great fear, fear about what may be in front of us, and that can be in terms of the violence and war that seems to be breaking out in more and more places. It could be fear about electoral politics in the U.S. and who we might or might not have a choice to vote for, not being particularly inspired. Fear of apathy and hopelessness that seems almost the rational choice. But hopelessness can never be a choice for activists. We have to struggle to find hope for ourselves and hope for the world, because that's, I think, the challenge that can really shut things down. Again, you know, to go back to something I said earlier, we may not be able to have hope that we can make massive, fast change and end war and violence, you know, tomorrow. But our actions make a difference. And I have this sign here in my study from, it's a quote from Bertolt Brecht, which I look at every day. Someone asked Brecht the question, in the dark times, will there still be singing? Yes, he answered, there will be singing. There'll be singing about the dark times. And I think that's the challenge, to find the space to sing, to dance, to work together, and to cling on to some hope against hope to build a better tomorrow.
I'd also say that we need to maintain a sense of humor about certain things in life, and that laughter helps as well.
Well, if you hear me singing or see me dancing, that there is humor inherently involved in those things.
Matt, what projects are you working on now? I know you wear many hats.
I mentioned the IPRA conferences, and yes, you know, there's work we do in the Musty Institute. You mentioned the work, the peace education work around King's anniversary. So I guess the last one I'll mention now is a project near and dear to my heart that a number of these above-named forces are working on. Actually, I'll mention two because they're connected. Globally, there's something called the Occupy People's Forum. And it's a network. It's been very quiet, mainly linking up internally over these last years, amongst eight people still colonized, still occupied directly by the militaries of their countries and the governments that are overseeing them. So the eight are Puerto Rico, the U.S.'s own colony, and Palestine, Western Sahara and West Papua, Kashmir and Kurdistan Rojava, Tibet and Ambazonia, the English-speaking territories in the Cameroon. And those eight peoples have gotten together and begun talking about shared practices and shared areas of potential collaboration and potential work. All of those people in different states and different areas of work and struggle are saying, ah, we're not going to be building movements against colonialism, movements for freedom and liberation, the same way it was built even at the very end of the 20th century. We have to look at 21st century movements. What does revolutionary nonviolence look like? What is building movements that may take power but not state power? What does it mean, as the Zapatistas say, to build a world where many worlds fit? So, again, the people of Rojava, one of those eight territories, are doing some very interesting new things that we haven't seen in liberation movements before. And I think those occupied peoples that are still building for a new level of freedom globally is one of the projects I'm in the middle of. The other one is a project of a group called the Spirit of Mandela, a coalition led by Black Panthers, former political prisoners, and their allies and friends. It draws off of the 2021 International Tribunal decision from a tribunal held in New York, but with nine judges from around the world, that looked at U.S. human rights abuses against Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples. And it found the U.S. still guilty of five counts of human rights abuses that together amount to ongoing genocide against Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples in the U.S. This coalition, Spirit of Mandela, has initiated a project called the People's Senate. It's a very ambitious project that's looking to build in every state of the U.S. empire, in every corner, including of territories outside of the 50, like Puerto Rico, and other colonized people in the U.S., indigenous peoples, Hawaii, Alaska, etc., an idea where there can be a space where people's voices from the grassroots can be heard. And it's slow building and not an easy process. But if and as the People's Senate and Spirit of Mandela Coalition, a Black-led coalition, continues to build, then maybe we'll see some of those movements, those peace and justice movements that I said earlier in the broadcast were less vibrant now than they were generations ago.
Matt, unfortunately, we are running out of time. How can listeners follow your work? And importantly, you and I have talked about TikTok. Do you have a TikTok account yet?
I think I have to give you my various TikTok handles to tell on the Law and Disorder website later on. Yes, I have a teenage daughter, so I do have a TikTok handle because she's told me how to do it. But no, I don't know what it is. So I'll get that to you later. And I have Instagram and all that kind of thing. But for now, let's just go to the website. Remember those things? Website.
Yes,
where I can tell people that very simply, the acronyms for International Peace Research Association is IPRA. So one can just say IPRA Peace. IPRAPEACE.org, IPRAPEACE.org, and you'll find my IPRA information. And similarly, one can go to spiritofmandela.org. That's just the word spiritofmandela.org, and find out the information about the People's Senate and that U.S. coalition, international but U.S.-based coalition I just mentioned. Those are the two best places. In addition, of course, Heidi, to the Musty Institute that you and I both work at back when I'm your boss.
Thank you. And that's ajmusty.org. Matt, thank you so much for all the many peace-related initiatives that you're involved in. And thanks for joining us once again on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We'd like to send a big thanks to the following stations that are now airing Law and Disorder: KWSI, 100.3 FM, Grand Junction, Colorado; KBOG, 97.9 FM, in Brandon, Oregon; WHMI, 93.5 FM, Livingston County, Michigan; WBDY, 99.5 FM in Binghamton, New York; KRJF, 92.3 FM, Santa Rosa, California; WXOJ, Valley Free Radio in Northampton, Maine; and WEFR, 1700 AM, West End Fairmont Radio in Fairmont, West Virginia. And for other stations who may be airing Law and Disorder, please let us know so that we can thank you and that we can include you on our website.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.